Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, music nerds. Well, I know I just wrapped up season 6 a couple days ago, 2 days ago, in fact. But today we just got the news that David Lindley had passed away, and I thought it would be a good idea to pull up the interview that I did with him back in 2019 and let you all have a listen to it. For anyone that missed it, this was originally a 2-part episode, and as listeners will know, I've had to yank out a lot of the reference songs, so the episodes have become shorter, and podcasts in general are allowed to be longer now than they used to be, so I'm combining those 2 episodes up into 1 here, and this is my entire conversation with David Lindley. So, you know, he was a huge influence on me. He was a fantastic musician, both as a session guy, and what I knew him as more was like a live solo performer. I saw him going back into the 90s, once with Ry Cooder, and then a couple times with Hanny Nasser, and then once with Wally Ingram. And he made these 3 records that to me were just like incredible and so inspiring for what I was doing, and kind of got me into playing Weisenborn, which is still to this day kind of my main instrument in a way. Anyway, if you ever get your hands on those, you can't find them on Spotify or Apple Music, but they're out there. Maybe you can find a CD copy on eBay or something, but I highly recommend it. There's 3 live records. 2 of them are from the same kind of thing, same kind of time period with him and Hanny Nasser. They're live records. One's called Playing Real Good, and the other one's called Playing Even Better. One's blue and one's orange, and they've got handwritten covers. You can't miss them. So go find yourself a copy, and it's like the most happening Weisenborn, slide guitar, oud, a little bit of banjo, all this stuff, and playing amazing songs and crazy arrangements and just, yeah, huge tone. It's acoustic, but just the tones are massive. And for me, it was really inspiring stuff. And then there's a 3rd one that he did a few years later with Wally Ingram, and that one's also really cool. That's called Twango Bango Deluxe. And I also got to open for him once in Vancouver. A friend of mine had a club there, and he was a huge Lindley fan and brought Lindley into this pretty small restaurant to play a couple of shows in one night. And I opened both shows, and we got to hang out a little bit, and he was really nice and a really encouraging, inspiring guy to be around. And that was just a really memorable gig for me. I loved it. So go listen to some Lindley. Go find one of those records if you can. If not, you know, his regular releases are also awesome. And this is my conversation with him from 2019, part 1 and part 2 combined. And thanks for tuning in and enjoy. Here we go.
Hi, how are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Oh, good.
I'm down here in the rain.
It's probably good when that happens around there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, sometimes it is. Yeah, everything grows and then everything burns, you know.
That's how it goes.
Pretty much.
Honestly, like with you, I'm not 100% sure where to start because there's so many facets to your career that I'm a fan of and that I'd love to hear about. But maybe we could start by talking about yourself as a player and some of your background. Like I know that you were kind of a young champ on the bluegrass festival scene in the early days on banjo and fiddle, and I've seen you play fiddle, but I've never seen you play banjo. And somehow I can't really imagine you playing like traditional Scruggs style banjo. Maybe you could talk about that, you know, your first instruments and what kind of music you were playing.
Yeah, it was my first instrument. It goes all the way back to when I was 4, you know, and I had a violin and a piano and had access to a piano, and I used to, you know, bang on that and then I got a hold of my dad's ukulele.
Yeah.
And started playing that, and he said, we'll get you a baritone ukulele. So I got a baritone ukulele, and then from then on it was, you know, one thing after another that had strings. So it was pretty good. You know, I the banjo was I've been listening a lot to the Kingston Trio, and there was a guy at the high school where I went, who was really good on the five string, and he studied with a bunch of different teachers and stuff, and he got Pete Seeger's style down pretty well. I learned that, and then from then on,
okay,
I met a guy named Walt Pittman.
Yeah.
Who was the guy who invented the Scruggs tuners?
Oh,
yeah, he was a friend of Earl, and Earl would send him, tapes and stuff, and he would learn all these things, and I met him down at Bernardo's guitar shop in East L.A. And this guy, this kind of Santa Claus guy, came in with a brown banjo case with a pink lining, and it had a Gibson Master Tone in there. And he said, "Are you sure you want to look at this?" And I said, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, break it out. You know? And that was it. It was one of those defining moments. And I picked that thing up, and I saw all these things. And that's when it started out. And I listened to everybody.
Yeah.
I had access to records and
what was your access to those? Like, were your parents really into music?
It was Barry and Grassmuck music. They were a big music store in Pasadena.
Okay.
And I used to work there teaching banjo and fiddle and all kinds of different things. And fiddle, I just kind of naturally picked up. I wanted to win the fiddle contest, so I learned a couple of tunes and did that. So it worked out pretty good.
So you were picking it up really fast, and you were going in competitions and winning them.
Yeah,
when you were 6 and 7 years old.
No. This was about 14, and I was from 14 years old on, and I had access to a guitar. And then, I got my own, my uncle was Ricardo Montalban, the guy.
What?
That, yeah, he's my uncle.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Your dad's brother?
No, he married my dad's sister.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He helped me get my first guitar. you have a guitar? He used to play guitar and sing at Christmas.
Really?
And he was really, really good. So he said, "Oh, we'll get you a guitar." So my dad and he got together and plotted and schemed, and then I ended up with a guitar from Bernardo's guitar shop in East L.A. And I used to go down there all the time. I'd buy tenor banjos and have Pilo put a neck on them, mm-hmm. And
he was like a tech down there that you were in cahoots with?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was Candelario Delgado's brother, Porfirio Delgado. He was a guitar maker, really, really good guitar maker. Jose Feliciano plays one of his guitars.
Wow.
And he was a real, really good guitar maker. He could make anything. So can you make a five string neck? Oh yeah. Oh, I do those all the time for Mr. Chase out in Claremont. And I said, oh good. So there's this interconnection. That's kind of when it started.
Okay.
Was that the banjo 12 string guitar kind of thing.
The interest of the banjo to you was more through like the Pete Seeger folky kind of sound than the Earl Scruggs bluegrass?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was until I met Walt Pittman, and then that's when the three finger style, that took over, and I went and I got a bunch of records of stuff of the old time, real serious old time Roscoe Holcomb.
Yeah, and that stuff.
Obrey Ramsey.
Doc Boggs
and Snuffy Jenkins and all these pre-bluegrass banjo players. So I learned all that stuff. And then I heard Eddie Adcock, the country gentleman.
Yeah.
And he was just amazing. And I learned as much of that as I possibly could. And then,
were you actually playing in bluegrass bands?
Yeah, we had a bluegrass band. We had me and Dick Hargraves, and and a couple of different people, and we ended up with Richard Green playing fiddle.
Okay.
And then it progressed in different members of the band, and it was Richard Green. He'd play fiddle, and he would win the fiddle contest, and I, and we got to be good friends. And he showed me a bunch of stuff, and he learned from Scotty Stoneman,
okay,
who was one of the best players. Yeah, the Stoneman family, and he was one of the best players around. So I got as much of that as I possibly could, and I learned off records, and people would show me different things. And there was a guy named Mike McClellan, mm-hmm. who was a kind of local whiz, and he could play everything. He played every instrument. And he would do shows at this place called the Cat's Pajamas.
Oh, yeah.
In Arcadia, yeah. And I'd go down there, and I'd hang out there. I'd talk to Mike, and he showed me a bunch of things. Tony Jackson's fiddle.
Amazing.
Bowing style, which was the bluegrass
yeah.
style that everybody used. And I learned that. He said, oh, you got to learn this. I said, okay, I'll learn that. And then I just took it and ran.
Were you finding that you were drawn more to the banjo than the fiddle, or were you just into everything?
I was into everything.
Okay. When you were playing with those bands, would you swap around and like you'd play fiddle on one song and banjo on another? And
oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
What about like flat picking guitar? Were you into that at all?
Not really. I'd go see Clarence White all the time.
Nice.
He was with the Kentucky Colonels, yeah. or the Country Boys. Before they were the Kentucky Colonels, they were the Country Boys. And that was Leroy McNeese on dobro, Billy Ray Latham on five string banjo. Roland White, played mandolin and Clarence White played guitar. And Eric White or Roger Bush played the bass, and I used to go see those guys all the time, and they were South El Monte.
I go and see Roland White all the time here. He plays at the Station Inn,
yeah,
he's still doing it, man. It's incredible all these years later.
Yeah, he was when Clarence got hit by that woman in the parking lot of that club where they were playing. Mm-hmm. That's when Clarence died.
Right.
He saw the whole thing.
Oh my God. Can't imagine.
Yeah.
Can't imagine.
Yeah. That was really awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the White Brothers were the kind of bluegrass standard.
Was he about your age, or is he a lot old? He's older than you, right?
Yeah. I'm not too sure about that.
Oh, okay.
I'm 74 now.
Okay.
I think he's still probably, he's a little bit younger than me.
So you were seeing those guys and they were kind of your peers, I guess. And you were playing around a lot.
Yeah.
Were you touring with any of those bands at the time, or was it just sort of local stuff that you were mostly involved in?
No, it was more or less local stuff. I was going to high school. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had to stick around, and during the summer I'd go play, and we'd play different places, the Troubadour and the Ash Grove and Cat's Pajamas and stuff like that. We did a thing every night there. So
wow, every night
Cat's Pajamas.
Amazing.
Yeah. It turned out, anybody could get up and play.
Yeah.
So they would do that.
So can you, like, your music over the years has involved so many influences, more than just, string band and bluegrass music.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about, like, how old were you when you started hearing things like reggae and dub and blues and rock and roll that has also been a big part of what you do?
All of that stuff came later. It was bluegrass music and old time music was first. And I would listen to everything. I listened to Ravi Shankar and Uday Shankar. And when I was really little, I was like, 6 and 7 years old when I heard Ravi Shankar or Uday Shankar.
Is that Ravi's brother or something?
It was his uncle.
Oh, okay.
And Ravi started out playing with with the with this uncle's ensemble, and then from then on, he, you know, I heard the first World Pacific record, and my dad got it, and then I got it, and I got it through the music store where I worked, and that was it. It was as soon as the you know, the sitar and the vina, and then I said, oh, what's this other instrument, the vina?
Yeah.
Okay, and I picked that up, and then I listened to Mohammed Al-Bakar and everything, you know, oud music from the Middle East, and everything just went all at once, you know.
So where were you hearing, like, where would you have picked up recordings that featured the oud? Like, where would you even find those records at that point?
At the music store where I worked.
So they actually had that kind of stuff in circulation at that point.
Yeah, and there was a guy in there who would order stuff, and they had a whole section on that. And then, of course, I checked out Tower Records. And Tower Records had all kinds of stuff, and I'd go in there and I'd just make a deposit. I wouldn't take anything out of there. I just go in there and give them all the money I made, and I would have records. Man, I had all kinds of records,
yeah.
And I'd listen to them and try to figure out what was going on, and then that was when the Kaleidoscope started.
Yeah, right. So Kaleidoscope kind of came out of your immersion in bluegrass, and like when I hear the early Kaleidoscope stuff, which is, you know, some of it's sort of available in various forms, it's hard to know what's official and what were bootlegs or whatever. Like, I don't know what you intended to come out, but you can hear a lot of it now. But you were like, I can hear your playing in there, like on the oud and guitar and stuff, and like recognize you totally, even at that point, and I'd imagine you were like 17 or 18 at that point. So can you tell me a bit about how forming that band and what you were trying to do with it? And like, it definitely was a rock band at the heart, but you were playing all this cool, crazy world music too. And so maybe tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, I had, I could check out different kinds of guitars and amplifiers and stuff at this music store, Barry and Grasmick, and I, Standell was really, really good. I checked out those things,
yeah, those are
the early Standells, and I got to know Frank Garlock, who worked down there, uh-huh. and he turned me on to all kinds of amps and Standell tube amps, the old ones that were made in the garage in Almaty. Yeah.
A lot of the steel players were using those, right? Like the Western Swing guys.
That was the best steel amp there was, the single 15. Yeah. And then you have the preamp in the top of the amp, and then in the bottom of the amp on rubber kind of insulation, you'd have the amp section.
Okay.
Of the amp, and those things were the best pedal steel amp in the world.
Yeah. So I noticed, like, there's even some footage of you guys playing, and you're playing, like, I think there's a song where you're playing a bouzouki, and I can see that you've got in there, and like, there's a volume knob on the bouzouki. So you were probably doing that yourself, right? Like, were you taking like DeArmond pickups and stuff and sticking them into those instruments?
Oh yeah, we did everything. Yeah, we put, you know, the first piezo electric pickups were Barkus and Barry. And when Barkus and Barry was a hi-fi store, they had hi-fi stuff. In
really?
That. Yeah. HI-FI.
Yeah.
And they had that stuff in there. And Len Barkus was in the back. He was messing around with all these different kinds of pickups. Mm-hmm. And Frank Garlock turned us on to Len Barkus, and he would put pickups in instruments. We would take things down to him, and he would put pickups in them. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, this is good. Oh, you ought to have one of these pickups, you know, that you could stick on any instrument.
Right.
You know, and then they did that. And they put this, and they came out with the first guitar pickup. I still have it. It's in a Gibson guitar case someplace, mm-hmm. and it's like number two.
Wow.
And it's just two pieces of aluminum with an element in between it, and they're glued together, and then you bolt it down to an instrument, and it plays, you know. And then from then on, it was that whole piezo kind of pickup thing that you could put on anything. So that was a real liberating thing for us. You know, you could put it on the oud or the bouzouki or the saws, and it worked out real well. So
were you guys trying to elevate those instruments into like a rock band setting, or was it just?
Yeah.
So you were playing them loud.
Yeah. I had my Gretsch solid body, and I had a Gibson fretless Wonder Les Paul custom with three pickups, and then we play oud and saws and bouzouki, you know, in with that stuff, and with drums and electric fiddle or harmonica and all that, and it worked out really well.
Yeah,
and we played in San Francisco and Los Angeles and played all over the place, the Newport Folk Festival in 67, I think it was, mm-hmm. and it just went on from there, you know.
Were you touring and stuff with that band?
Well, most of the we'd kind of center in New York around the Albert Hotel, which was at 10th and University, and we had a. Then we'd go and play up in Boston,
yeah.
and then, you know, in different places and stuff. But mainly it was in New York, and that was, it was a long time. It just, you know,
yeah.
we kind of lived there. 10th and University at the Albert, and we'd rehearse in the basement, and the lady who ran it was really wonderful.
Okay.
She let us rehearse,
yeah.
and so... And we kept going and got bigger gigs and stuff like that. And then we stopped kind of, and then, you know, different members of the band changed around and got into a whole different thing. And then I said, oh, well, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to play with Linda Ronstadt and Terry Reed.
Yeah.
I went to England and played with Terry.
Yeah, can you tell me about what made you move to England after Kaleidoscope? That's sort of a...
I heard Terry at the Sky River Rock Festival uh-huh. up in Seattle, and I said, oh boy, this guy's good.
Yeah.
This guy is really good. And the guy on Chesley Milliken was his manager. And Chesley, but we knew him from Magic Mushroom, which was a club on Ventura Boulevard,
okay.
he opened up.
Yeah.
And it was where the Allman Brothers, when they were the Hourglass, that's where they would rehearse.
Oh, okay.
And they played there all the time. And it was Chesley was a big center of everything. You know, it everything he touched kind of turned to gold. So we had him manage the Kaleidoscope for a while. And then he went to England and managed Terry Reed. And I gave him a call about the time the Kaleidoscope broke up. And I said, I'd like to play with Terry.
Okay.
You know, and he said, oh yeah, that's good. That's what he said. Okay.
Really?
And you
got the gig.
Yeah, I got the gig and we went on from there and we got, Bruce Rollins from the Grease Band and Chrissy Stewart from the Pretty Things. And we played four. There's four of us. It was me and Terry and Bruce and Chris Stewart.
Yeah.
And that was a great dance, boy.
Now,
that really smoked.
Is there a record?
You know, of that particular band, I don't know if that exists or not. I haven't seen Terry in a while. Uh-huh. And I would like to see if recordings of that band exist. I don't think they do. The next band was with Lee Miles and Alan White, who is, He played drums with Yes.
Oh, right. Okay.
After us, you know, and but that band, that was really the best band. And Lee Miles played with Ike and Tina Turner, and Alan was just fabulous. He was great.
Yeah.
He and I, yeah, we got into all kinds of trouble. Boy, that's like
like what kind of trouble?
Oh, bad stuff. You know, we went to Amsterdam, took acid on the Queen's birthday, and it was carnival.
Oh my God! You know what? I've been to Amsterdam on the Queen's birthday. It's crazy. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's unbelievable. And we had a hotel. We were playing a gig there in Amsterdam,
yeah.
and we went early, so you know, it had a couple of days to kill. So we got into all kinds of trouble. Me and Alan, we went to this Indonesian restaurant, took acid. Okay, we're in an Indonesian restaurant and on acid, and he decides to sample the condiment tray with all this hot stuff from Indonesia, and he got I've eaten the hottest thing in the world, and he went into the bathroom and he got sick, and it was this awful thing. I'm okay now. And he came out, and we went out, and the first thing we saw was a neon sign shop.
Uh-huh.
That was the first thing we saw when we walked out the door. Right next door to the Indonesian restaurant was a neon sign shop.
Uh-huh.
And I said, this is going to be good. So then we walked off into the night, and we found the bumper cars.
Oh, my God.
So here we are. Yeah, the bumper cars with a lot of juice flowing through there. and Alan almost got killed. He stepped off that thing onto the floor. They turned it off, and then we... It was downhill from there, because we went to the Paradiso Club.
I know it.
Yeah. That's it. We went there upstairs and watched these guys play Go and chess and all.
Fascinating.
It was unbelievable. And it was, you know, he was a real bad influence on me.
So that was still with Terry Reed, where you guys were both in his band?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. We were on Terry's band, and we played the Paradiso then.
Yeah.
After that 2 days of being insane, then we played the Paradiso, and we played places in Germany and Austria and Switzerland.
So with Terry, Terry Reed, what, like, were you playing guitar with him at that point? Like slide guitar and stuff? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Slide guitar. That was the first slide guitar stuff.
So tell me a bit about how you got into slide and like what you were into at the time. And, you know, that's such a big part of what you do now. Like maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, that was a, electric slide guitar. I saw, when I was with the Kaleidoscope, this is towards the end of it. I saw Freddie Roulette play.
Oh yeah.
And I saw him play, and I went, oh, holy shit. This is really good. This is really good stuff. And he was, you know, Freddie Roulette, you know how he plays.
Yeah, he
plays all that Alvino Ray stuff.
Totally.
And then he plays all this other stuff too. You know, I want to do this. And I talked to him, and he said, this is what you get. You know, 8 strings, that's a little much. You get a 6-string and then you a national. You get a national and he showed me some things, some different techniques and things. And I said, okay, I got it. Oh, you got it. I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, I got it. So I went and I bought this national electric slide guitar down in Hollywood. I took it home and I shut everybody out. And that's what I did for a long time. And then I took it to England and started playing with Terry Reed. And that's more or less when it started. At the end of the Kaleidoscope, the beginning of Terry Reed is when the slide guitar started, and then from then on, and Chesley was also friends with Jackson Browne.
Yeah.
So I met Jackson through Chesley Milliken, who was Terry Reed's manager, and he was also he was connected with the Grateful Dead, and was, later on.
Yeah,
with him, and then he was connected with everybody. So,
so when you say you were into getting into slide guitar through through Freddie Roulette, and he was showing you stuff, like you're talking about lap steel here. You're not playing Bottleneck at this point. You're playing lap steel.
Oh no, I have never played Bottleneck. Okay. I can't play Bottleneck. You got your Rycooter, you know. That's all you need is Rycooter on the Bottleneck guitar, and that was it. And so I one of the things about Freddie Roulette that was amazing is that he would play it like a lap steel guitar, and I went, okay, oh, this is good.
Yeah,
this is kind of a different thing, but I can do this.
Right, right.
And so I picked up the sixth string and took it and played it with Terry. And then I played it with Jackson Browne, and then...
If you were listening to records and, like, you must have been learning stuff at some point after Freddie Roulette had sort of put his mitts into you. What were some of the records that you were learning from that were a big influence for you on the steel, on the lap steel?
Earl Hooker.
Yeah.
Earl Hooker. He had, in fact, Freddie played in this band, and he was really good. And I got turned on to a whole kind of different world of this Chicago kind of slide guitar and different things, and, you know, Sacred Steel, and I checked this stuff out and said, this is really good. You can do all kinds of things. And then I would, depending on what Jackson would need in his songs and all that stuff, I'd say, oh, I got something for that. Let me play this. And then he'd say, yeah, that's good. Okay. And then we would do that for a while. You know, for 7 years we did that.
tell me a bit about your stint with Jackson Browne. So you came back from England with Terry Reed. You got a gig with Jackson Browne. He was just like a kid starting out at that point, right? Like you were playing with him from the beginning, right?
Yeah, right from the beginning. I played a gig with him at the Troubadour, and I played with him at we did a gig at the Magic Mushroom in mm-hmm. Cambridge.
Okay.
Chesley started this club there, you know, the same as the club on Ventura, except really small. And then we played a gig there, and I said, this really works good. I'll be back pretty soon. You know, I was left England and went, but took my wife and daughter and who had come over. Mm-hmm. They were living in England. We were going to stay there, you know.
Oh, okay.
It was the Vietnam War, you know. I says, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So we were going to live in England, and I you get homesick and all that stuff. And I had heard Cajun music, you know, Doug Kershaw and all this stuff. And I said, oh no, I want to know, we're going to do this. So I went back and, started up and got a gig with Jackson, and that was it.
Yeah. Cool. So how much recording, like, I know Kaleidoscope was doing some recording, and we've talked about Terry Reed maybe not making a record. With Jackson, you started making records pretty, like, right from the beginning of his career. How much studio experience did you have at this point?
I had pretty much studio experience. Terry Reed made a couple of albums. One of them was called River, and we made that towards the end of that band, and that was at Olympic Studios and Island Studios, and I got to know Chris Blackwell, what was going on there.
Yeah.
And all, you know, when you were in England in those days, 69, 70, and 71, reggae was all over the place.
Okay.
And the Wailers, Bob Marley and the Wailers, they were just starting out. So I heard the early stuff. I got a bunch of reggae records in Trojan label, reggae label. They had a whole bunch of records, and I got them.
What were some of your favorites?
Oh yeah, Desmond Dekker and the Aces. That was the first thing I heard. And then I heard the Pioneers and the Rudies and the Greyhounds. It was a huge thing in England at that time.
It had a huge impact on you because it's been a part of your music.
Oh yeah.
Ever since El Rayo X. I don't know if it was before, but you know, you hear it on those early El Rayo records and then it stuck with you. So that must have had a huge impact on you.
Oh, it was giant. Yeah, I heard that and I went, oh, that's man, they sing just like bluegrass.
Right.
You know, these guys listen to all those radio stations there in Nashville and New Orleans. And they got a lot of the techniques of that. And a lot of that technique was bluegrass music. And I you know, these three-part harmonies and all that stuff. I said, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Let's do this for a while. So I put a bunch of, you know, stuff together when I was playing with Jackson at the time. And, yeah. And he produced a record. It was that first El Rayo X Blue record.
Yeah, man. It's one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah, mine too. And that was, I got a bunch of musicians together, you know, from all the people that I'd met in the studio and all, you know, I played on all kinds of things when I got back. And Reggie McBride on the bass, and Ian Wallace I had heard with Lonnie Mack's band.
Nice.
And I said, oh, this guy's good. This guy is rock solid. So I get him and get this guy, George Pierre Bonaparte, yeah. Babu, and got him. And
he was on percussion, right?
He was on percussion, and he also played accordion, and he wrote songs and stuff. Yeah, it was, I had Babu on the timbales and timbalitos up in front, and Ian in the back, and Jorge Calderon on the bass, and Bernie Larson on rhythm guitar, and that was it. And then we started that machine. And that learned to feed itself. We went everywhere.
If we talk specifically about that Blue record, can you tell me what the sessions were like? Like, if you actually think back to the process.
Man, they're really good. It was based around Greg Ladani, who was a recording engineer for Jackson. He said, oh, I want to do this. I want to do this album. So we did it in the studio where we recorded Jackson stuff.
Oh.
Record one and Sunset Sound, nuts, Sound Factory on Selma. It was a studio run by Val Garay.
Uh-huh.
And he and Greg are really good friends, and Val had all kinds of really good equipment. And Greg was kind of the second engineer, and he wanted to do this project. Yeah, the Sunset Sound Factory sessions, those were mostly overdubs in the actual sessions.
Oh.
Actually, we did them in both places. We experimented around a little bit, uh-huh. and we got the same sounds.
Okay.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you guys were making that record, was it essentially a live performance? Like the band was all playing together,
yeah,
all in the same room and stuff. Like how the interesting thing to me is like they sound like they have that record in particular has a really live energy, but it also sounds quite produced and like, you know, like kind of in tune with a lot of other recordings that are of that era. So I'm just wondering, like, how,
yeah,
you know, how, were you doing a lot of overdubs and was, were the sounds pretty live and raw, or were you spending a lot of time on that kind of stuff?
It was essentially, we do the, record the song first, and I would do a pilot vocal, which ended up in a lot of cases being the main vocal on it.
The keeper.
And you get a lot of microphone leakage, and then there were some tunes that you had to start from scratch and record it a different way, you know, and that was, you know, and then overdub on it. You know, I would overdub things and solos and redo a guitar or one of those things, you know. And I was experimenting with the Dan Electro guitars and the chorus and stuff from playing with Ry Cooder.
Yeah, right.
And I said, oh, this is good. This is a good sound.
Tell me a bit about your guitar tone of that particular era, like what kind of steel, lap steels you're using and amps, and if there's any effects involved and stuff.
Well, the amps, for the most part, were Dumble.
Okay.
I used an overdrive special for the lap steel.
Okay.
And there was a National lap steel, and then I used Rickenbacker lap steels, and then I got turned on to Supro, which was a subsidiary of National,
right.
Falco, and I used those, the Supros with the legs on them. You could stand up and play, you know. And then I used, for guitar, I would use a Dan Electro curly horn guitar, two pickup guitar, the kind that came in the case that had the amp in it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've got one of those actually. Those are great.
Oh yeah, those are really, really good.
And were you using did you use the case amp on the record?
No, okay. I didn't use the case amp.
Those are pretty gnarly.
They're pretty gnarly. I used mostly the black Fender basement.
Okay.
Pre-CBS, I used a black Fender basement head, and I'd plug it into an AC-30 Vox AC-30 bottom that had these two special speakers in there that were really good. I used those or a Dumble bottom, which had two Altecs.
Was Howard Dumble just a guy that you knew building crazy amps at that point? Like, obviously, he wasn't the mega crazy elusive superstar amp guy now, where his amps cost $100,000. Like, he was probably just a guy at that point, right?
Yeah, he was just a guy. The amp guy in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And then he moved down to Sun Valley, and the prices went up. You see, they were really good.
Was he like experimenting with amps on you at that point? Like, was he just getting into building?
Well, he was just starting to build stuff, and he would listen to people play and how they would play, and then he would make him an amp, you know.
Right.
And it worked out really well because he was a guitar player. So he'd have you come over.
Yeah.
You'd come over, you bring your guitar, and he'd listen to how you played and check out the pickups on the guitar, see how they worked, and, you know, say, okay, well, let's see. We'll put this kind of preamp in there and see how that works. And you know, he said, well, okay, I'll build you one. So I remember going in there with a black face bassman, and I said, and I had another device, and I said, I want to put this device in this amp.
Yeah.
Okay. At the time I was using the black face bassman with a FET circuit in front of it.
Okay.
And I was experimenting with preamps that would overdrive the preamp in a black basement.
Okay.
So I tried all different kinds of things, Wolinsack tape recorders and
cool
Tanberg tape recorders, and I checked them out, and I put them into this. I said, oh, this is good. This sounds really good.
Yeah.
And then he said, yeah, that's a good preamp. And he would put all this stuff together, and the overdrive special came out of that.
So you're kind of responsible for the overdrive special.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, you know, people in those days were experimenting with all kinds of preamps,
yeah,
and all kinds of, you know, things from projectors and
Bell and Howells,
you know, Bell and Howell tape recorders and all those different things. And then you put them in front of something that was pretty stable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered a Variac.
Oh.
And a Variac, yeah, you take those things and you turn them up until it was 121, you know, coming out of the wall. And you go, okay, that's good. Okay, and the tubes are glowing a certain color orange. You want the tubes to glow orange, and then you want to have just a touch of blue in there. So all that sounds good, because a blackface bassman was susceptible to the power coming out of the wall.
Oh.
The sound that would come out of that, and that's one of the reasons I got the Overdrive Special, was to kind of counteract that effect.
Oh.
And I got Variax, and I got you know, changing from, you know, I was obsessed with Vox AC30 amps, and they didn't run on 60 cycles. They ran on 50 cycles.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so I said, what I want is a cycle generator. I want to be able to take the power out of the wall and convert it back down to where it's supposed to be, down there at 220.
Yeah.
And 50 cycles. And he says, oh, that's $20,000. No, you can't have that. No, you can't have that. Lindley is not going to get a cycle generator. So I settled on, I said, blackface basement. Okay. So I put a Variac in there, and I made sure that it would stay at the same power out of the wall.
Yeah.
So, and I'd adjust it. And it turns out that Eddie Van Halen was doing the same thing, and Billy Gibbons was doing the same thing. And we figured out that we needed a little more input,
yeah,
to amplifiers and stuff like that. And Dumble at the time was doing experimentation with different amps.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, oh, this is good. This sounds really good. This is what I want. You know, and I take it in there, and he put it together, and you know, and it turned out to be this monster. You know?
Amazing. Another tone, I guess, going back a year or two into the Jackson Browne thing, but like one of your most famous solos really is the Running on Empty thing, which was interesting,
yeah,
too, because it's kind of it's like a live record, but it was all new material. So it's a real cool concept record. What about at that time? Like what would you have been using for the lap steel sound on those records? Same kind of thing or?
Well, that was a Rickenbacker.
Okay.
And that was one of those Bakelite bowling ball,
yep,
plastic guitars, you know,
yeah,
and,
sure,
and I took off a couple of the covers,
mm-hmm,
on the little resonation kind of chambers on there. I took a couple of those off, and it had this sound that was wonderful. And I said, okay, this is good. And then I tuned it up to A.
So it's real tight.
Yeah, really super tight. So I tuned, and Rickenbacker is a short scale.
Yeah.
So you can kind of do that. You can kind of, if you use the right strings, and they'll last maybe 3 days, and the first string at least,
mm-hmm,
you would, you know, I had a whole lot of different Rickenbackers and National and Supro and different guitars. I had a Gibson that had a brass bridge. And I would use these different guitars, and I had, you know, like six or seven of them,
yeah,
up there at one point. And I would use, they were all different versions of the same tuning.
Yeah, okay.
I always used the same tuning, which was like a first position E chord.
Yep, yep.
On a guitar, yeah, I used that tuning, except I would tune it up to F, G, and then all the way up to A.
Whoa! Oh, seriously, so it's open A tuning, but like an open D style open tuning, just tuned way the hell up.
Yeah, it's the open D tuning.
Yeah.
It was starting at the bottom, was D, A, D, F sharp, A, D. The first string was D.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the acoustic tuning that you use. Okay, and then on electric, it was that same relationship. I said it was F, and then I have one at E, one at F, one at G, and then one at A.
Wow, that is high.
Yeah, that's really high. And you couldn't do it with a National because the scale was too long. So yeah. You do it with a Rickenbacker. You have a short scale.
Okay.
And tune that sucker up, and it would just about ready to explode, and that's what you're hearing on there.
Okay, cool. And amps and stuff like that, were you using the Dumbles on those tours?
Yeah, or? Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, just plug into a foot volume control and the foot volume control into the Dumble.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would use something in front of the foot volume control. I would use a Purple Peaker, one of Dan Armstrong's things, or I would use a...
What's the purple one? Was that a compressor of some sort?
Purple Peaker was a... Nobody really knows what it was. I had nine of them. I got one left, and it just does something to the sound.
Oh, you know, okay.
It's basically a Stratocaster.
Okay.
It's the overtones that a Stratocaster amplifies.
Okay.
So you put that in there.
Yeah.
You put that in there and into the circuit, and that, boy, that makes a hell of a sound. I think that's what I was using on Running on Empty was the Purple Peaker.
Oh, okay. Wow, I got to check that out. So it's like a mystery effect. You don't even know what it does.
Yeah, there were little boxes that Dan Armstrong used to make.
Yeah, I remember.
I used to hang out with him. There was an orange squeezer.
Yeah.
He'd make them so you plug them into the guitar and then you plug your guitar cord in there and you turn it on and all hell breaks loose. they were just the best, you know. And a lot of different effects. I used a phase shifter. MXR yep. phase shifter, and then a red box. I'd use one of those overdrive kind of compressor limiters, the red box MXR.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what Lowell used. He said, I used to take an LA-2A out on the road, and they proved to be just not roadable. So
he actually had one in his live rig, an LA-2A?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
He had an LA-2A. The LA-2A said, that sounds good, you know, so put it in the amp, put it in the powertrain, and he would use that, and he said, this thing just won't hold up, it's not roadable, here's something that's better, and he showed me this little red box, and I said, what is that? Oh, it's an MXR compressor limiter, and you put that in there, and you just adjust it around until you get the sound you want, and there you go.
Yeah. So simple.
Yeah, solo. And when you go to take a solo, you just stomp on that thing.
Okay.
And there you go.
Almost like using it just like as a boost pedal more than anything, but also a compressor.
Yeah, it was a boost pedal, and then you would be able to compress it and limit it down and a line level limiter, you know, like an LA-2A. Essentially yeah. what it is, but reliable.
Right. Roadworthy.
Yeah, roadworthy. Lowell really did some experimentation before he ended up with that. So
I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about your sessions have been a big part of your career as well, but it seems to me like maybe it's not your favorite thing to do because you've always tended to go out on the road more than be a session guy. Like, I'm pretty sure if you yeah. wanted to, you could have just stayed in LA and been like the session kingpin of the 80s and 90s and 2000s, right?
Yeah, I decided to go on the road. I liked that interplay between the audience and the musician. I thought that was really a good thing. So I remember I ran into a guy named David Cohen. Uh-huh. David was a fingerpick guitar guy at the Ashgrove. I mean, he would teach classes and he'd do all kinds of stuff. And he was a great guitar player. And I remember talking to him, and he said, you know, I decided to stay in town and be a session musician. that's what I wanted to do. And he would have three sessions a day, and he would maybe 5 days a week or maybe 6 days a week. And he did like Lee Sklar.
Yeah.
And he would go do these sessions. And he says, I want to go out on the road like you're doing. And can you take all my sessions? I said,
nice guy.
I said, no. Yeah, and he said, oh, well. You know, so he really wanted to, you have to kind of balance that stuff off, you know. I recorded with a lot of different artists and stuff, and I you know, I still playing live is the thing. That's really it, you know. Yeah. And I decided to just keep that going, and you know, occasionally do sessions when I'm home. And
in those days, like in the 80s and 90s, I would imagine you could have been doing sessions all the time, and you chose not to. The ones that you did do, you know, like there's so many great ones, but you did a lot of records with Linda Ronstadt and that trio record with Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt and Dolly Parton is incredible too. That for me is, from what I can hear, really, now I might have missed something on one of the El Rayo records, but that's the first time I ever hear you playing the Weisenborn on a record. Is that true?
There was one El Rayo X album that had, it was El Rayo Live.
Okay.
It was a pink album. I don't know if, I think it was released in Japan and in Europe. It was a pink brick wall album cover on there, and it had all the information was in Sharpie and it was, and on that was the first Weisenborn thing.
So was Weisenborn something that you just discovered later, or were you always playing it and you just never recorded it?
That was the first thing. That was, I would say, one of the first instruments, that bluegrass instrument. It had bass, unlike a dobro.
Right.
So I was messing around with it a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
When I worked at Barry and Grassmack, I saw a Weisenborn against the wall, and I said, "What the hell is that?" So I picked the thing up. It's this guy named Ron Middlebrook, who is a really old friend of mine. He played Rickenbacker electric guitar, and he was a guitar teacher at Barry and Grassmack, and it was one of his. And I checked that thing out, and I said, holy shit, this thing sounds really good. I checked it out, and I went, oh, okay. You know, a little light went off in my head. I said, yeah, use this. This is a great thing. So I kind of cataloged it, and then later on, I went out and bought one.
Okay.
And that's the acoustic version of the lap steel.
When I hear that record, the trio record with Linda Ronstadt and Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris, there's a solo that you do on there that, for me, like when I was learning Weisenborn and like lap steel and stuff, I was so drawn to that solo. I think it's on To Know Him Is to Love Him. I don't know if you remember that song, doing that song or not.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So to me, it sounds like you're plugged in directly. Like, I don't hear any acoustic sound at all. Were you using it that way in the studio? And am I right hearing it that way?
Yeah, it was a Sunrise pickup.
Yeah.
And it was George Massenberg recording that, and and we plugged it in. We did, we had a microphone on it, and we plugged it in direct, and then we had, I think there was an amp in a room, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was all three of them. So
oh, cool.
he made a mixture of all three, and he said, this is the only pickup that I've ever tried out that it will hit 26,000 cycles. He says, my parametric equalizer actually works on this instrument, so we'll make use of that. So, and it really did. Those old Sunrise pickups, they had 26K in there, all the way up. Yeah, up into Dogland.
Yeah, that's up there, man. 26. I don't know if, like, can we even hear 26? I guess yes, George Massenberg can.
The, Yeah, we can. Yeah, Massim, at least he could, you know. I mean, I was on my way downhill about that point, you know.
Okay. And so, like, on a session like that, would you, like, that was big time in those days. Like, that was as big as it gets for, like, pop stardom.
That's as big as it gets, yeah.
Were you doing those solos and things as overdubs on tracks that were already there?
No, sometimes I would do it at the time, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And then Linda would say, oh, you can do better than that. And,
really?
And yeah, oh, yeah. And then Dolly would chime and say, oh, yeah, you can.
What was the dynamic like with those three? Because, I mean, if they were actually in the same room recording at the same time, that must have been a total trip, man. Those are like three of the greatest singers ever.
Oh, yeah. It was fabulous. They figured out how to do it. And they would practice. It was constant doing stuff. Uh-huh. You know, we were in there, and they would work on tunes in another room, you know, while we were learning the song and getting ready to record. And then we would record the track with, and one of them would come out and sing the song so we would know what it was like maybe keep that take and then add a two harmonies onto that. That was one method, and there was, you know, a dozen methods of recording these songs because they're all pros. I mean, they've been recording stuff and doing, you know, making albums and stuff for years. Dolly Parton, you know, one, you know, Linda Ronstadt, you know, she came out of the womb singing, and Emmylou Harris, and
ugh, forget it.
Yeah, it was fabulous, and it was one of those times where you know make a mental note of this because this only happens once.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I did that. You know, I got to hang out with all these great musicians. And
a couple others that come to mind, like, so as we mentioned, like, you kind of just left that life behind a little bit and turned a bunch of stuff down, but you did play on records with Bob Dylan, and I know you played on like a Curtis Mayfield record. Do you have a favorite session or two that you could tell me that really sticks in your mind as being like super inspiring and just a great experience?
There was one. People get ready, there's a train coming with Curtis Mayfield. That was on the Sundays program. It was David Sanborn's program.
Oh, yeah.
And he had played sax with James Taylor, so I got to know him really well. And he got a TV program. He says, come on TV and play some songs. And Curtis Mayfield is going to be on there, too. So I said, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, I'm there. So I flew to New York and did that. It was a 14-hour session. And people get ready. There's a train to come. And Curtis Mayfield says, you want to play on this? I said, oh, you bet. I'll do that. And he said, yes, let me hear what you got on lap steel, you know, up on legs, lap steel up on legs. And he says, that's the same tuning I use.
No way.
Yeah. It was an F tuning. And he said, this song is an F.
Crazy.
So I said, oh, that's really good. This guy can play all my stuff. And he said, oh. I said, let me hear what that sounds like. And he said, this is good. This is a good thing. So we did that song. And he turns around to me. Curtis Mayfield turns around to me in the middle of the song and he says, play the solo, David. I said, what? Wait. No, that was it. I said, and there was this big neon sign that came, and we did it with an audience there. There was an audience sitting in bleachers up there.
Okay.
And this sign came on in between me and the audience that was in the bleachers. It was a neon sign that said, don't screw up.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
And it was good. It was a good solo too. You know, he liked it. That was the main thing. I mean, throughout all this time.
Terrifying.
It was terrifying. But it was one of those things, you know, I said, if I'm going to go down, you know, 11 million people are going to watch this thing.
Yeah.
If I'm going to go down, I'm going down in flames.
Yeah, man. Go down in style.
That's it. So I said, okay, here we go. So I played the solo, and it turned out really good. He loved it. He thought it was good.
Amazing.
And then I figured out it was an old thing. I'd been doing that all along. All of the stuff, that mindset, going in there, playing the solo, you know, people will remember this sound, so you better make it good.
Yeah.
So I will, you know, but that moment, that was a big thing, because all the stuff, you know, afterwards came in there. During the solo, I didn't see or hear or, you know.
You're just in the zone.
No, I was in the zone, and I said, okay, now I know what this place is. Now I know what the zone is, and don't think.
Whatever you do, don't think.
Yeah, don't think, and it'll come out really good.
Amazing.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll just do that. I'll just do that for the rest of my life, and everything will be fine.
Don't think. From Dave.
Yeah, don't think. Yeah, it's a big.
That is a big thing.
Yeah, it is.
With
and
music,
but you have to do all the preparations first.
Right.
Yeah, you have to make sure everything works. You have to get the best sound you can get, and then you take that right on out.
Yeah.
And do it for the people, and it works out really good. And also for Curtis Mayfield or Jackson Brenner or Dolly Parton.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
And they like that.
Can you tell me a bit about your relationship with Ryan Cooter? Like, I'm obviously a big Ryan Cooter fan as well, but you've had a pretty long-standing thing with him where, you know, you guys have made live records together, you've been on albums of his, and the soundtracks. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you guys connected and, like, found a way to work together, because, you know, a lot of the... It's some of it's similar territory. You don't do the same thing as he does, but it's in the same ballpark. So maybe talk a little bit about that and your experiences, particularly with the soundtrack stuff. I'd love to hear about the soundtrack sessions.
I'd known Rye for a long time, from the banjo fiddle contest and then from the Ash Grove, and he was the bottleneck guy and the fingerpick guitar guy, and then he was also the first electric Ryan Cooter album with that Stratocaster with the
Cooter caster. Yeah.
Yeah. The Cooter caster, you know, and I said, this is really good. This is fantastic. And played in this band and did all the stuff. And we played the No Nukes concert and did all that stuff. At that point, I had done a couple of movie sessions for him in Walter Hill.
Right,
The Long Riders and,
yeah,
and,
I love that one.
And all that stuff. We did that, just by the seat of our pants.
Can you tell me, like, what that means? Like, did you have the movie playing in front of you, and you were...
Yeah, and we played to
riffing
it.
Riffing off of that?
Yeah,
okay.
The movie would be playing, and we played to it.
Improvising, or were you playing pieces that
no,
he'd written?
No, I was improvising, and then if he hit on something that was really good, he says, Rye would say, oh, do that.
Okay.
Do that a bunch. Okay. I said, okay.
So he went into the scoring of those movies basically with a blank slate.
No, he knew exactly what he was doing.
Oh, okay.
He would say, you know, oh, we got this one thing for Geronimo. Say, let's take Geronimo. I said, we have this one thing. And I started to write a bunch of different things around this based on Methodist hymnal.
Oh.
So you go in there and you play. We went into the sound stage and they had all these regular musicians.
Yeah.
Sid Page and he had a string section and all this stuff, and they would play like shape note singing but with instruments. And they would do the brass. They did this stuff. It was old sounding. Uh-huh. And then we do the string band things.
Yeah.
And they sounded old too. You know, he said, don't play bluegrass.
Right.
I remember that. I said, he said, don't play bluegrass.
Okay.
So I came up when I was playing mandolin. So
tricky.
I played. Yeah. It's different. It's a kind of different approach. And then with the long riders, that was one of those things where you sit and you watch the track and you'd play.
Okay.
Just go from this number right here. There would be numbers on the screen up above. Go from this number to 2001, you know, at the end of the thing. So, you know, just play something good and interesting in there.
Okay.
And it'll work.
What about instrument selection? Like, were you just picking randomly, or did he say, like, why don't you play the bouzouki here or something?
He knew exactly what he wanted. You know, he kind of checked things out, and then if it was something else, I said, well, that'll work good, but bouzouki has a little bit, you know, the strings aren't as tight as a mandolin, so bouzouki will work really well here. Check this out. So I would play it, and he said, oh, yeah, that's good. The octaves. Those octave strings on there, that's what we want. So, and I said, yeah. So we would use that instead of mandolin.
Cool.
And then we got into all those things, and then we got into the Turkish classical instruments, the yali tambour and the tambour and saz and all of those things. We make use of these. This is a good thing. I was also doing soundtracks with James Horner at the same time.
Which ones were you doing with him?
Willow.
Oh, really?
There was that, and there was a couple other things that I would do with James. He was the soundtrack guy.
Right, yeah. That's big time.
So he called me up, and he said, come on over. And it was, it would be a session where we look at the screen and play.
Yeah.
He says, this, you know, and I also, I remember going to England doing that. The same thing, look at the screen and play with this Irish traditional band.
Yeah.
Would
James Horner say, play this, like give you a line to play? Or was he just like, be Dave? And
no, he said, go up the neck. You know, I said, oh, okay. Well, it may not be in tune. He said, yeah, that's what I want. Okay, I want it not in tune. Okay.
Wow.
That's good. And he was tremendous. That whole soundtrack thing just kind of took off. And with Rye, it was kind of the same approach. It was a different thing in those days, you know. And I think James heard that I had been doing stuff with Rye, and he wanted that kind of thing. And I don't know. I never know.
Do you think Rye wanted you around because you were like in the same ballpark as him, and it maybe made him feel more comfortable?
Yeah. There could have been that too, really, because we came from the Ash Grove, and we would go every night and see the same people and you know, McCabe's Guitar Shop and all that stuff. And we would, we were kind of reading from the same hymnal, you know?
Right. Yeah, I get it. What about Jack Nitzsche? Did you work with him on soundtracks?
Yeah. I worked with him on a couple of them. And
what was that like?
That was wonderful. He'd use the same approach, and then it would work out. Sometimes it wouldn't work out, and he would end up doing it on piano, you know.
Okay.
And he was great. It was wonderful working with Jack. He's the same kind of thing. He was one of those improvisational musicians.
Yeah.
You could get all kinds of things out of there, you know, and he would do, you know, playing live to the screen, go from this number to this number. Okay. In fact, he was one of the people who showed me how to do that.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. And he was, Yeah, he knew how to do it the regular way, conducting an orchestra. And
yeah, because he was totally fluent in orchestras, and yeah, that was his vibe.
Oh, right? Yeah, scoring and doing and all that stuff. I mean, you look at a score, you know, for this or for that, and you know, and he'd give me a sheet of paper that said, you know, it just had a clef on it.
Yeah.
It was a piece of music paper that just had a clef on it. And a key, and the key was D.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it said Weisenborn. And I went, oh, okay.
Cool.
You know.
Blank page. Right on.
Yeah, that's my kind of shit. That, well, I can do that.
Did you ever show up to a session and have somebody stick a chart in front of you with notes that they wanted you to play?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
How'd you deal with that?
That was Mike Post. Mike Post is an old friend, and he did the Hill Street Blues. And,
sure, yeah.
And, you know, all kinds of television scores and stuff. And he and I go way, way, way back.
Really?
And he taught himself how to do all that stuff.
Amazing.
And he got an orchestrator and started working with him, Pete Carpenter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, He would, you know, I go into every once in a while. I play the fiddle on something and play it all scratchy and weird. And he says, I remember this time. He said, he stopped the orchestra and he said, Mr. Lindley, don't you like what we wrote for you? I said, I don't know what this stuff is. You know, he started laughing. He had stopped, you know, a little bit. And Mike, it was really wonderful working with Mike. I did some soundtracks and stuff with him, and it was for TV music. And and it was very difficult to go from one world to another.
Right, totally different approach from what you were used to, I guess.
It's a totally different approach, and it's just as good, if not better.
Right.
When you write the stuff out and you want it to be a certain thing, yeah. And he was familiar with what I played, and he would write it, and it wasn't alien, it wasn't like impossible to play,
but
it was, and he knew what to do. And there were a lot of times where I make it all the way through, and I, you know, and it worked fine.
Uh-huh.
So it was just that one time I remember, you know. The guy coming around.
You don't like what we wrote for you.
Yeah, you got a guy come around. He's got an armload of these sheets, yeah. And they have all these golf clubs on them. And he sticks one in front of you, and I said, "What the fuck is that?" I don't do that. That's not part of my job description. So I said, "Oh, let me try. I'll try it." So I would kind of do stuff, and I'd do it different.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't like that. Mike,
that's hilarious.
No. It had to be the regular thing. He says, it's easy. You can do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I said, really? I said, I'm old. You know? I automatically kind of close things off when someone says it's easy.
Right,
you
know, right.
Oh, it's easy.
Easy for you, asshole.
You can do that. No, I can't. I can't do that, you know, and it was one of those things where I decided at one point in my life to go the other way,
mm-hmm.
which was the, you know, Nachati Celik. I want to learn to play like Munir Bashir.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I want to learn to play like. I want to learn to play like Munir Bashir with no time, no drums, and just the instrument, just the oud.
Yeah.
I'll do that for a few years. And that was one of those things, you know. And sitting there, you know, with the world's greatest French horn player, this guy had played with the LA Philharmonic. He was a monster, this guy. And he ended up playing things. And it was just phenomenal. And he came by. He came by and said, it's okay. That's, you know, I know what you're doing. You know, and this guy was really cool.
He helped you through it.
Yeah. He was interested. He's interested in the folk process. You know, a lot of people, the folk process, and then the sight reading and, right. and all that. It's you do have to make a decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting, man. If you have time, I would love to talk to you just a bit about your duo partnerships with the all those great records with Henny Nasser and Wally Ingram later. Those for me, like, as I was saying, like I heard the El Rayo X and that was a big thing for me, but as I was getting into playing those instruments that you play and like learning those things, I first heard that live Henny Nasser record and it totally changed my life.
Oh, wow.
Can you tell me about just like what made you want to go out on tour with somebody like that, where you found him and what your intention was with that?
You hear him play, you know, you hear Henny play. He came over to the house one day and he was playing with Ian Beardsley, who's a flamenco guitarist.
Yeah, sure.
And I said, this is really good. And I said, you want to go out on the road? He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, I want to go out on the road. And so we went out and did gigs. And I said, you'll figure it out. And I showed him a bunch of things. I showed him the New Orleans stuff and the reggae stuff, and he could play it.
Yeah.
I said, oh, that's good. So we went out on the road for a few years.
Was that like 4 or 5 years or something you did stuff with him?
Yeah, more like 4 years, three or 4 years with Henny, and then I hooked up with Wally Ingram, and that was more like what I kind of intended in the first place, was kind of Pots and Pans and
right. Yeah, he was hitting all kinds of crazy shit.
Yeah, and I said, yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Just do that, and then I'll play and you play, and then it'll be good.
Was he a guy that you knew from playing around L.A.? That's where he's from, right?
Yeah. He had played with Jackson, and I remember a live concert where he played with and Barbara Kay and Pat McDonald played, and I said, this guy's really good. He also played with Jackson. He sat in with Jackson, played absolutely appropriate stuff, and he played appropriate stuff with the Timbuk 3, and I said, you want to go out on the road? And he said, yeah, that'd be good. And so he and I, you know, I called him one day and said, you want to go out on the road? And he said, yeah. And so we did. And,
right on.
And it worked out real good.
It sure did. Well, those records are so great sounding too. Like, was it always intended for it to just be a live thing? Like, you never did studio records with either of those guys, right?
Yeah. Well, the live recording of me and Henny, that was, I just said, well, let's record this. And then I listened to it and I said, this is a record.
Yeah.
And then with Wally, it was more a studio thing. And he and I we'd do it live, and then we'd put extra stuff on it.
Oh, right. Okay. That's the Twango Bango record.
Yeah. It was all of that stuff was always recorded live, and it worked out. It worked out really well. And then we'd overdub stuff. I mean, I would overdub, you know, I do it usually with an electric guitar, with a Dan Electro.
Oh, okay. So over top of the live recording, you overdubbed.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And there was that. And then we would do the whole song. If it was a Weisenborn thing, I'd record Weisenborn, and then he would record drums, and we'd be in the same room, and it worked out really good.
And so in the last few years, I know you've mostly been doing solo stuff. Is that just like another choice that you made, where you felt like you were getting your point across better? Or was it like, I know you've had ear problems too. Was it like a volume issue or where?
Yeah, it was a tinnitus thing where it's a, you know, constant ringing in both ears.
Yeah, man.
And that's what it's really pervasive in the industry. I mean,
yep.
Jeff Beck and Pete Townsend and Eric Clapton and a whole lot of different people that played really loud at one time. You know, we did all that and then now we have issues. So it kind of goes with the territory, you know, and I look at it like that, but it's also, you go out and you can get your point across better when you do it by yourself. Yeah. You can, you know, and there's no conflicting thing about, you know, keep them dancing and doing all this stuff. Yeah. You don't have to do that. And they sit there.
Uh-huh.
They sit and they like it a lot, but they sit there and they check it out. And I'm playing a little bit differently now too. So,
So are you actively in the middle of touring right now? Or are you taking a break, or what's your
status? I took a break for about a year, and I'm about to go out and do a few things and see how it works. And it's kind of testing the waters, and I think it'll work pretty well. So I may fire it up again and go out and do the whole thing. So
do you have to adjust like what you're like your rig and stuff to be just like on a quieter setting overall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Constant adjustment.
Yes. Yes.
It's okay. What it is. Yeah. And the, all the different tunes. I've written some original stuff, and I'm doing all that, and I'm right in the middle of a CD, and I've done seven tunes. I got to do seven more, and then
what can you tell me about that record?
Oh well, it's just in keeping it biblical. See, I've done seven tunes,
yeah,
and then do seven more.
Yeah.
So yeah,
solo stuff, or is it a band, or what's the?
It's solo stuff. Well, it's both. You know,
oh, okay.
It depends on what the song needs to have, but I'm keeping all the tunes open. You know, this, you know, maybe two of them will be completely just guitar, you know, and then maybe I'll do a taksim on the oud and one on the bouzouki. And I've taken a bouzouki and put saz frets on it.
Wow.
Yeah, so instead of three strings, you have four strings.
Right.
And you can...
lower? Like if there's a lower set?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
So it's like two instruments on one.
Right.
And that's the way I play it. So there's that, and then there's the Weissenborns, and I've got a couple of other instruments here that are... you know, and I may do some guitar stuff. I may just do some of these songs on guitar.
Beautiful. Well, that's exciting. I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, I think it'll work out pretty well. I have a couple of guitars that are real good. I got a Saga. It's a copy of Mario Nakaferi.
Uh huh.
Guitar that Django Reinhardt played, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, there are two of them. There's the oval sound hole, and then there's the D-shaped sound hole. I have the D-shaped sound hole one. And I've been, checking it out, and there's the... That's a Yali tambour.
Okay.
Which is a banjo.
Amazing.
So, it's back to the banjo.
Good. Full circle, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it works out good. Chumbush, and there's a lot of chumbush on this album. Chumbush is a 12-string fretless banjo.
Right.
And it's tuned like an oud, and you kind of play it like an oud, and it really sounds wonderful. It just sounds great. So
I've seen you play that before. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a monster.
Right. That thing. Yeah, man, I could talk to you all day, but I can't thank you enough for taking the time, man.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's, you seem to know what you're talking about, and that's the main thing, because sometimes I do it in an interview or kind of talk or something like that, and the person doesn't know what they're talking about, but you do.
There's nothing worse than that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, man.
All right, thanks so much for listening, everybody. That was part one and part two combined episodes of my conversation with David Lindley from 2019. Thanks for tuning in. Go listen to some David Lindley. Thanks very much. We'll see you next season. Thank you for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. You can visit us online at www.stevedawson.ca. As always, I would like to thank Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver, BC for his help with research, and we'll see you next month for another gripping episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.